We have with us Sanjeev Sanyal, who is Prime Minister's Economic Advisor, of course. And recently, one of his comments on the UPSC exam went viral.
We all know, in fact, Mr. Sanyal as a member of the Prime Minister's Economic Advisory Council, but he wears very many hats.
Member of the Economic Advisory Council to the Prime Minister of India.
The colonial period, and even after the colonial period, what is the story we tell ourselves? You know, we are some sort of a passive people. We won our independence by, you know, politely requesting the British to leave. What a rubbish. Now, there is no argument in favor of Shastri Bhavan. No civil servant should be asked to come up with 21st century policies from an ugly building, 1960s building like Shastri Bhavan.
You know, earlier you shared with me, you have, you know, interest in building ships, which is something I would not have, you know, imagined from your work, Sanjeev.
This is not about fast cars. It's about the show. It's about the urban buzz. So the Formula One racing done in Singapore is done in the middle of the city. Using normal roads, they upgraded them and other things. And yes, over one weekend, yeah, you shut it down. And it's a real big party. Right.
Sanjeev, welcome to Sparks. Really looking forward to this conversation. In preparation for this, we are doing a bit of, you know, background research about the work you have done, how you got into policy making and so on. But we came across an interesting history of your family. You know, your great grand uncle, Mr. Sachindranath Sanyal, he had this famous debate with Mahatma Gandhi about the freedom struggle. So many people from your family, they have participated in the freedom struggle in, I think, 20s, 30s, 40s. I'm guessing growing up, you would be hearing all these stories. So, aapko tabhi lag gaya tha ki mereko matlab desh ke liye kuch karna hai, come from such a illustrious family. Like, how did that background shape, you know, the choices you made?
So, you're right. Many members of my family did participate in the freedom struggle. And remember, they came from the non-violent, but from the violent resistance to the British. So, both my mother's and my father's family were involved in the revolutionary movement. Mm-hmm. Several of them were sent to Kala Pani, beaten to death, hanged, and so on. So there are many members who did, as I said, participate.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, of course, the famous debate between Sachindranath Sanyal and Gandhi on the nature of armed resistance to the British. So, yes, I did grow up listening to many of these stories. I knew actually some of these people when I remember I am old enough to have been around in the 70s and 80s when some of these people were still around. So, for example, my great grandfather Nalinaksha Sanyal, who was a part of Bagajatin's Jugantar group way back during the First World War, he was still around. He was in his late 80s, but I knew him rather well, and so on. So, yes, they had some diffuse impact on me. I can't say I was conscious of it. But ironically, even though I knew these anecdotes, I didn't quite appreciate how they were all linked or the scale of what they were attempting to do till I began researching this book, Revolutionize. So it's only when I began researching it systematically did I also understand what they were attempting to
do. So much, And do you think, and you know, I was going through your book, I have not finished it, but I feel ki India mein this, you know, I mean, non-violence side of freedom struggle has been documented, celebrated, much talked about. But I think you talked in the book that there's, you know, over 50 years of continuous struggle, sacrifice. I mean, the, you know, what your family contributed to this, I'm sure many other families, that part of story has not been told very well, you know. Is this something, you know, we should all know a lot more about? Because that's
so. First of all, the armed resistance to the British is not just about those last 50 years, which that's the revolutionary phase, which I have written about in this book.
Right,
it's there from the from the beginning. So it's the Sikh, the Marathas, the Poligars. There was continuous armed resistance to the British.
Right.
Now, the phase that I wrote about in the book Revolutionaries is the last phase of armed resistance. It is not the only phase.
Right.
And yes, it was unfortunately almost wiped out of our memory. Deliberately, I would argue, because it did not fit into a certain political narrative that the Nehruvians wanted to portray after independence. So they quietly pushed it to the side. In fact, I would argue they deliberately sidelined it. There is a famous historian called R.C. Mazumdar, who was originally given the role of writing the official history of the freedom struggle.
Yeah.
And when he was sort of bringing a more holistic view of the freedom struggle, he was sidelined. And it was given to somebody else to rewrite it. Similarly, the many sort of important sites of the revolutionaries, almost sacred sites like the cellular jail and so on, they were almost all demolished. So in the case of cellular jail, the bits that you see today are the only surviving bits. Actually, the site is much bigger.
Right.
It's only the last minute that two radials were saved. There were many other radials. So what you see when you go to the cellular jail is a very small part of what the original complex. And it was literally saved at the last minute.
Right.
But there were other places which were not saved. Like Maulana Azad Medical College, right? That's actually on the site of Delhi Jail, where many revolutionaries were hanged. It's a sacred site.
Yeah.
But it, you know, in the 1950s, when that old jail was demolished and the new one being built, the revolutionaries, the few surviving ones, had asked that it at least the area of the gallows is preserved. And Nehru promised to do so. But when the site opened, it had been demolished. And so on and so forth. Those who participated in the INA, those who participated in the naval mutiny, they were not given freedom fighter status till well into the 70s, when many of them were, most of them were dead.
Right.
So, point I'm making to you is that the fact that we don't hear very much about the armed resistance to the British, and we hear, we are told the story as if the non-violent movement was the only movement, it's not by chance. This deliberate narrative building has been done to diminish the role of the armed resistance.
In history, you know, people talk about many histories or a perspective through which, you know, somebody is telling history. And from a, you know, common man point of view, unless, you know, you seek out and, you know, go to archives or read, you know, well-known histories, you have just one very narrow perspective. But in your work, I've seen, Sanjeev, that I think you really like history. You know, most of your books are kind of an intersection of history, culture, economics. Where did, you know, this interest in history, and also, I mean, must take a lot of time and research, you know, that some of the stories are reading in a book, you know, those are not known at all, like you going to, you know, this particular temple, reading, you know, the inscription on the temple, you know, some interesting stuff you write about, you know, Ashoka's, you know, his, you know, relationship with Buddhism and so on. Like, just very curious to know, you know, your interest in history and, you know, your process also.
So, I, ironically, I am not trained at all in history, right? I am purely trained as an economist. And when I was in my high school, I would have been what would have been called the science maths type.
Yeah.
So, people would have been entirely shocked that I was going to make a name for myself as a writer, and that too of history and short stories and things like that. But just as an aside, most of my writings still are not on economics. Very often, they don't come out in my name.
Right.
So, for example, for 5 years, I wrote the economic survey.
Right, that's right.
So now, I mean, that doesn't come in my name.
Right.
I mean, I did sign one of them, but it doesn't come out in my name. So, the bulk of my writing is still economics.
Right.
But the history that I write that you talked about, look, I am a firm believer in the following thing. That all these things are interconnected.
Right.
So if you don't understand your history, you don't understand your economics. If you don't understand your economics, you don't understand your history. You have to understand the politics, environment, urban design. All of these things are interconnected.
Yeah.
So it is very important that you have an understanding of the interconnections.
Right.
You know, for academic purposes, it may be useful to study them in silos. But the world doesn't function in silos.
Right.
And as far as what we are trying to do, remember that we are not trying to just build an economy.
Yeah.
We are trying to rebuild a civilization.
Right.
So when we are trying to rebuild a civilization, we have to take a much more holistic view of things. Now, the economy is a very important part of that.
Yeah.
So we are putting in an effort. Right. And you are aware we are now the world's fastest growing economy by some margin. But even that success is still just one brick in the wall.
Right. Right. Got it. So you're saying, you know, understanding history helps us understand where we are coming from, what our roots are, So as we're making...
And also the wider context.
Mm. Right, right.
After all, you know, ancient India was also an economic success.
Right.
Unfortunately, it turned out to not be a military success. Mm. Turned out, and that was a bad thing.
So we hear a lot about, you know, people say that 500 years ago, India was contributing 25% of world GDP compared to, you know, 4% or so today. But how do you interpret that? You know, since you were looked into it, you understand that 25% GDP passed over. What does that mean?
So, first of all, be very careful. These are very rough estimates because we didn't have national accounts at that time. Yeah. Nevertheless.
No economic survey.
Yeah. So, these are most of these are based on best guess by a chap called Angus Madison. Mm-hmm. Now, Angus Madison, people, you shouldn't actually only go for back 500 years. You can go back much earlier also. Mm-hmm. And he makes the point that India, in fact, contributed 1/3 of the world economy between the year 2000, between the year zero, mm-hmm. first century, and 1000.
Right.
So for the first millennia AD, India was contributing 1/3 of the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from there, that share begins to decline.
Yeah.
So by the time you are in the 1500s, 1600s, our share falls below 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So, do remember that even at that time, we were in decline.
Yeah.
So, this is an important thing to understand. Right. That is not our peak. Mm. Our peak was earlier.
Right.
And by this time, 1500, 1600s, China becomes the world's largest economy. We are no longer the world's largest economy. And so, that you can clearly see the impact of the Turkic and then the Mongol conquest of India.
Right.
But it's still the very large part of the world economy. Mm-hmm. Then... by the time the British, in the 1820s, our share has fallen even further below.
Yeah.
And by the time the British leave, our share of world economy has fallen below 5% of the world economy.
That's right.
Importantly, the socialist period turns out to be continue the same trend. So instead of after independence, our share of world economy going up, it actually keeps declining. So it actually falls below 3% by the mid-90s.
And do you think we as a country missed a trick there, you know, that opportunity almost like...
Absolutely, we missed an opportunity. The socialist years were completely wasted. And there is no way of justifying that period.
So almost two generations had to pay the price.
Yes, and then from then on, it has gone up.
Yeah.
Now, remember, this whole calculation is done on PPP terms, purchasing power terms. So, in purchasing power terms, our share of world GDP is now close to 8%.
Right.
So, we have come from 2.5%, 3% range in the 90s, where it has declined from around 4.5%, 5% to around 2.5%, 3%.
Right.
Now, we have gone back to close to 8%.
Right.
So, post-liberalization,
our
share of world GDP has,
by
all accounts, gone up.
Right. And look, you know, you have directly contributed to this in your role in the government. You know, we as Indian, we all feel very proud of, you know, the continued pace of economic development. You know, now people are genuinely starting to believe that we are going to be take any number, you know, 20, 25, 30 trillion dollar economy by, you know, 2045 or so. But from a lot of, you know, reforms, bold reforms that I'm pretty sure, you know, you were involved in has, you know, contributed to this. This pace will continue on its own, will require a lot of heavy lifting and different type of reforms that, you know, that should come in next 5 or 10 years to really support. Because very few economies in the world, you know, barring maybe China last 30 years, who have maintained this kind of growth for 3-4 decades.
So, let me be absolutely clear that growth is nothing God-given about. Okay? It is earned. The reason we are growing right now is because we put in the effort. So, policies matter. If you have bad policies, you get bad outcomes.
Right.
Okay. So, the socialist period, we had bad policies. So, we had stymied growth.
Yeah.
Of course, the people at that time blamed it on Hinduism and called it Hindu rate of growth. But it had nothing to do with Hinduism. It had everything to do with bad Nehruvian socialism. Now, from the 90s, we began to liberalize our economy. Yeah. And our economy has clearly done well for it. Starting from the 90s, there was an acceleration of growth. The original reforms were done in the year 91, 92, thereabouts. By 93, we stopped doing reforms. So that momentum of growth then died out by the early years of the Vajpayee era.
Yeah.
Then Vajpayee era, there was a bunch of reforms. That created some momentum in growth.
Yeah.
That did flowed through into the first Manmohan Singh, UPA one. But they also didn't do any reforms. Then that momentum died out.
Yeah.
Growth was then forced to keep going by pumping up the banks, etc., which led to bad outcomes, as you know.
Yeah.
But growth began to flounder again. Then the first Prime Minister Modi's first term was then spent essentially cleaning up the banks, introducing new reforms, such as, for example, the GST, the inflation targeting, insolvency and bankruptcy code, many other things.
Right.
Then the benefits of that would have begun flowing through by 21 or so. Unfortunately, we then lost 2 years for COVID. So it's only from 22 that we began to see the real momentum in the economy come back.
Right.
And now we are in 24.
Yeah.
So now we have had 2 years where we have been the world's fastest growing economy. But the reason I told you this long story is that just because we have done a bunch of reforms in the past does not mean we will get growth in the future.
Right.
Future growth has to be earned today. So while the things are going well, we have to be doing the next generation of reforms. And there are a huge bunch of reforms to be done, and no end of reforms that, you know.
What, this must be also a very complicated process because we are a very diverse country, different perspective, even economic, and you are an expert here, different economic theories and so on, you know, what does a developing country should do, our own cultural perspective, historical perspective. Just give us a color on what goes into thinking of structural reform at a country level. How does one
say very, very frankly, most of what needs to be done is common sense.
Yeah. Okay.
You don't need great theories.
Yeah.
In fact, personally, I'm extremely suspicious of these great theory ones.
Yes.
Okay. Especially having dealt with them during the COVID period and all the random advice they were giving to us. So most of the things we need is common sense.
Right.
We need to do a large number of process reforms. Okay. Every one of our processes is got large number of inefficiencies.
Yes.
None of those inefficiencies are ideological.
Right.
Okay, there's just bad policies. I mean, having large number of KYC requirements is not because of some great theory, right?
Yes.
It's just inefficiency.
Yeah.
So there's a large number of process reforms we just need to do.
Right.
And there are literally thousands of them. And the resistance against them will come from interest groups, bureaucracy, other things. But there's no theory resistance to it.
Right.
It's a practical business of administration.
Understood. And is there a pace to it that you have to only do, like, you know, learning to walk before you run kind of thing? You have to reform this before you can reform that?
Sometimes you need sequencing, yes. It depends what the reform is. Sure. Sometimes you have to think through, this is the sequence you want to do it.
Right.
Many often you may do a reform and it may not work in the first instance. You may need to fix it along the way. So, for example, GST. GST was introduced knowing fully well it won't work in the first instance.
Right.
Then we fixed it after introducing it.
Right.
Okay. Now, you could have the view that, no, we need this perfect system and then introduce. There's no such thing.
Right.
You're dealing with a complex, wobbly economy and people are doing all kinds of things.
Right.
So most of the things that went wrong with the GST system when it was introduced were not the things that were predicted.
Right.
There were things like, you know, the error correction button in the website doesn't work, something like that. That can only be found out by doing it and then fixing it. So one of the things that has happened is that we happen to be a point in history where the population is willing to allow the administrators to go out there, do complicated reforms, allow them to then fix them retrospectively in some ways. Now, this is not common in history that this sort of feeling is there. This willingness to take the pain for future gain is there. So, as it happens to be, we are here. For whatever reason, the population trusts the Prime Minister's judgment.
Yeah.
And so, we are able to consequently implement these huge reforms. And I mean, no, it's not just reform, the infrastructure.
Yeah.
Building of infrastructure is a very messy thing. Yeah. Right? It creates disruption. There's dust in the air.
Yeah.
It's like living in a construction zone.
Right.
But Indians do not mind it because they can see progress.
Yeah.
So this kind of national acceptance of disruption for future gain is a major moment in our history.
Right. Yes, and it's probably very powerful because we all know in generally in democracies, you know, you have a limited term. You want to do things which will show results immediately so you can, you know, talk about infrastructure is a very long-term thing. Even reform, as you mentioned, some of them are complex, may take 5 or 10 years to for the full benefit come through. But, you know, I agree with you, you know, we are in this unique point in history where the trust is there, and which is, and it also requires some courage and boldness also on behalf of administration as well to take those calls, you know. So I think
so we are a sweet spot for whatever reason,
right?
whether the public acceptance or the willingness of policymakers to take risks. And we shouldn't waste it.
Right.
Because, you know, it's very easy to get stuck in moribund situations. If you want to know what that feels like, look at Europe.
Right.
I mean, it has obvious problems, but doesn't seem to be anybody's job to fix them.
Right.
And so Europe has got completely stuck in a quagmire from which there is not even an attempt to get out of.
Right.
America, for whatever it's worth, is still a fluid system.
Yeah, that's right.
It has many, many problems,
right?
But it's a fluid system.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine at some point, you know, somebody will emerge who will try and fix it. But Europe is completely moribund.
Right, that's right. And for, I mean, say a lot of youngsters, you know, watch this podcast. So from their perspective, look at next 5 or 10 years. Let's imagine somebody in their early 20s. I think people are quite optimistic about the country and the prospects. But in just from policy point of view, should people expect just continued wave of reforms, probably even more aggressive, bolder things
yes.
to come?
And India is not the place to come for, you know, slow, comfortable life.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. You know, you'll see reforms of all kinds. Mm-hmm. This will create all kinds of opportunities. Right. So this is the place to come for if you want to see rapid change, if you want to see extraordinary opportunities, entire new vistas being created and opened up.
Right.
This is where it's going to happen.
Right.
And you can feel it in some ways.
Of course, absolutely.
You know, anybody who is yourself,
yeah.
you know, look at the extraordinary, completely new businesses that have popped up from thin air.
Right.
So this is where it's happening.
Right. And sometimes it's a, I mean, do you also, I mean, there is so much excitement about India. Some cases, sometimes even hype, you know. Now people are looking at things in very rose-tinted glasses. Does that worry you at all that, you know, probably, you know...
It does to some extent. Particularly, not because we think we won't meet those expectations. That is not my real worry.
Yeah.
My real worry is actually a slightly different one. See, if there's too much of a rush of money, it'll create bubbles.
Right.
So even if we achieve whatever we do in the long run... Along the way, it will create unnecessary choppiness.
Right, right.
And that is not always easy to manage. So if there's a huge rush of money at the same time, FDI is coming, FIIs are coming, this thing, you see, you will suddenly overheat the system.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a limit to how much the financial system can allocate without beginning to misallocate.
Yeah.
So this is something that we have to manage.
Right.
Secondly, the big risk, other big risk is that because the system is anyway... doing well on a macro level, a lot of sins will get forgiven.
Right.
And this is why it is very important that we keep reforming, keep opening, cleaning up.
Yeah.
The insolvency and bankruptcy code, for example, has to keep working.
Right.
If under these circumstances, your company is still not making money,
right.
you've got to be declared insolvent and sold off.
Right.
Right.
And swiftly so that, you know, everyone can go back.
Yes, because if you begin to accumulate garbage now, at some point in time, it will become too much and it will shut down your system. What's happened to China?
Right.
But China is actually the good case.
Yeah.
Where they kept the system going for 30 years and now they have a real estate and banking and other problems.
Right.
It's not obvious that you will hit that hurdle in the end of 30 years. You may blow up much earlier. I mean, that's what happened to Thailand and Indonesia and so on.
Right.
They were all just like, they were on the same journey. In the 90s as China.
Yeah.
In fact, they were ahead of the curve.
That's Asian Tigers.
Yeah, the Asian Tigers. Then 1997-98, there is an Asian crisis.
Yeah.
Now, many of these countries never come back.
Right.
Korea did get back on the rails, but many of the others didn't get back on the rails.
Yeah.
I mean, Thailand and Indonesia and Malaysia have never quite regained their glory days.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, it is not obvious that if we don't manage this...
Right.
And don't keep reforming it.
Right.
Don't manage the macro stability issues. There's nothing God-given that, you know, we will sustain this growth.
Right.
And this entire thing is based on compounding.
Right, that's right.
It's not about a growth of any one year.
That's right.
It is about compounding over many, many years.
That's right.
So, first point, do not lose sight of the fact that you have to keep reforming.
Right.
Do not lose sight of macroeconomic stability.
Right.
If in doubt, sway towards creating extra buffers in the system.
Right. Yeah. No, 100%. And I think I'm speaking for myself, but I think a lot of people believe that, you know, we have right intellect, right willpower, right mandate. in the government to make sure, you know, we are paranoid and continue the way of reform?
Absolutely. It's only the paranoid who survive.
Absolutely.
So if I'm sounding paranoid, then let me clarify, I am.
You know, compounding is very powerful. All of us as Indian citizens would love to see, you know, 7% compound over next.
Yeah, so anybody who comes and says, oh, no, you know, we're doing 8, we should try and do 9, please tell them to set aside.
Right. Absolutely. We want 8% over next 20 years and we'll be all happy place. You earlier you mentioned, you know, we're building civilization, you know, which is a lot more than only about economic growth. And I think, you know, before we started, you know, showed you talk about, you know, one of your big areas of interest for you is this urban planning and development. In fact, you've done some incredible amount of work in Singapore, which is I was actually honestly not aware of. I want you to talk about that, you know, both your interests and what kind of projects you were involved in, because we have our cities don't look like Singapore today. Maybe Gurgaon does to some extent now, but we have, you know, cities need to evolve a lot. So I'm very curious to learn your experience. You know, what kind of works you've done with Singapore? Also, how do you translate some of that to what's happening with our...
So, I lived in Singapore for many years, and you're right. I was involved in various ways and in part of their urban thinking. Now, the problem in India is that urban planning in India has not gone through its 1991 moment.
Hmm.
So, it is essentially stuck in the Soviet five-year plan idea of a master plan.
Right.
These rigid building codes. Hmm. So, you know, one of the things that is quite stunning about Indian cities today is that with a few exceptions of maybe the new parliament or something, we have not built any really iconic buildings since independence. Okay? In fact, what really is shocking about Indian cities is the extent to which basically we have replicated concrete boxes. Okay?
Right.
But if you look at cities before independence, colonial and pre-colonial cities, look at the variety of urban outcomes.
Yeah.
You know, Jaipur is clearly different from Udaipur.
Right.
Udaipur is clearly different from Chennai.
Mm-hmm.
Chennai is clearly different from Bombay,
right.
And so on and so forth. Yeah. And of course, you know, Varanasi has its own feel.
Yeah.
So why were they having all these different kinds of outcomes and evolving? Because look, there's climatic change, there are differences, there is cultural differences. There is use differences. Mm-hmm. Some cities are administrative. Some cities are for religious purpose. Yeah. Some cities are for commerce. So, depending on location, purpose, time and history, they develop different kinds of cities.
Yeah.
After independence, we have got uniform drabness. Mm. Why? Because we introduced this Soviet thinking process, top-down, mechanical, Cartesian kinds of things. You know, so basically, we had an industrial view of what a city is. And where does it come from? It comes from basically that the thinking of the 1940s and 50s, which is very industrial.
Yeah.
So what do? We introduce five-year plans for the economy.
Mm.
We introduce national building codes.
Mm.
Then we call in a fascist called Le Corbusier to plan Chandigarh.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Le Corbusier literally says that, you know, buildings are machines for living. So you have this machine view of things.
Right.
So we then end up creating this mechanical, machine-based thinking of a city, whereas a city is actually an organic, complex system.
Mm.
So what we end up with as a result is these rigid building codes, which force you to build these ugly box-like monstrosities.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when you try to break away from it, you know, there is a huge amount of vested interest which doesn't want you to do it.
Yeah.
Even look at the, you know, Central Vista project. You know, there are a large number of people are deeply unhappy about it because jamun trees are getting hurt. What rubbish. I mean, what really is happening is that we are replacing Shastri Bhavan. Now, there is no argument in favor of Shastri Bhavan. It's an ugly building. No civil servant should be asked to come up with 21st century policies from a ugly building, 1960s building like Shastri Bhavan. It needs to be pulled down.
Right.
Okay. But we are unable to do this. Why are we unable to do this? Because we have embedded into our heads these ridiculous building codes, this ridiculous idea of a master plan. Now, what is a master plan? Master plan is the idea that there are some people right up front will decide what the ideal city is and then will enforce it.
Yeah, okay. In the way of organic growth.
So, like, just you ran businesses. I may ask you for a business plan just to get a general sense of what you're trying to do. But do I ever ask you to run a business according to your business plan? No, you would have failed miserably.
Business plan, ignore Karna is the best thing to do.
Exactly. This is, business plan is just there to get a, some general sense of the parameters, maybe the infrastructure requirements or something.
Right.
So the same thing is true of a city.
Yeah.
You need to have a general sense of what is it you're trying to do, some of the trunk infrastructure that you need to put in.
Mm.
Otherwise, the city has to be allowed to evolve.
Right.
Why are we zoning? I mean, who are these people who are being able to predict what economic activities are going to happen there 20 years from now? By the way, if he does know how know what economic activities will be there 20 years from now, why is the guy not Elon Musk?
Right.
Why is he sitting in the town planner's department?
Fair. So just, you know, you mentioned some of the work you were involved in Singapore. You see, so whenever somebody from India goes to Singapore the first time, it just, you know, makes an impression on you. But thoda sa, you know, maybe some insight of, you know, as when you were looking into that, you know, you shared a lot of your inputs, which are implemented in various projects. Thoda, you know, some insight about.
So let me show you how the thinking process is different.
Right.
So everybody thinks that Singapore is well planned. No, it is well managed. Very different idea.
Right.
Because although there is a planning in Singapore, they are continuously updating and evolving it. And so Singapore, when you go there, you will see, especially when you see it from the air, it's a very organic city.
Right.
There are lots of curved roads going, swirling, etc.
Yeah.
When you see Delhi from the above, you'll see actually it looks orderly.
Right.
Okay, so Delhi actually looks orderly from above because we have force-fitted a certain rigid plan.
Right.
Whereas Singapore is much more fluid about the whole matter.
Right.
So ironically, Singapore is not planned, it is managed. Because they're managing an organic system. Now, let me show you how the thinking process is when you have a zoned, rigid thinking process and a fluid thinking process. Let's go back to maybe the year 2007, 8, 9, that phase. I was living in Singapore then.
Right.
They were at that time thinking of bringing the Formula One racing to India.
Right.
They were thinking the same thing in Singapore.
Right.
So, in Singapore too, they thought about, you know, we need to create a circuit, etc. Yeah. There's a circuit in Kuala Lumpur and so on. And so there was a discussion in which I also participated. And basically, they had the discussion, and that same discussion at that time was happening in Delhi.
Right.
Now, in Singapore, they eventually came to the conclusion that, look, it's a small city. They don't have enough land.
Yeah.
And in any case, and here is where the insight comes, that this is not about fast cars. It's about the show. It's about the urban buzz.
Right.
And why should we put that urban buzz in some box somewhere in some using up large amount of real estate?
Right.
Why not race them using the city, the insides of the city?
Right.
So the Formula One racing done in Singapore is done in the middle of the city.
Right.
Using normal roads, they upgraded them and other things. And yes, over one weekend, you shut it down. And it's a real big party.
Right.
And yes, the cars may not be able to go at the fastest possible way. But anyway, you know, if you watched a Formula One, the cars are going too fast. You can't tell how fast, which car is what anyway. You have to look at the screen to make out what's going on.
Right.
So whether they are going at 250 kilometers per hour or 350 kilometers per hour is irrelevant because they are anyway too fast.
Right.
So this is real. So they understood this as an urban buzz. Now, at exactly the same time, I came to Delhi and I met those people who were involved in this discussion. I told them, look, it's a waste of time building the Budh circuit.
Yeah.
Why don't you do the same thing here?
Right.
Raise them on Rajpath, which then whatever path was called Rajpath.
Right.
Take it around CP.
Yeah.
Back, you can create a circuit. Just imagine these cars racing around the middle of Delhi at night with fluorescent cars. With helicopter buzzing above.
Right.
You don't need to advertise India as a tourist destination.
Right.
People will just come. And I said, do it immediately after the Republic Day parade. Aapke stadium bhi bana hua hai udhar.
Right.
You are anyway putting up those things. So just do it 1 or 2 days later.
Yeah.
And it'll be a fantastic show. No. The cars will not be able to go fast. We need to build a dedicated thing. Now, they didn't understand that this is not about engineering and fast cars because they have a mechanical thinking process.
Right.
They have this zone. We need to create a zone. Uske andar fast cars hoga. Whereas in Singapore, we have gone, they basically thought about it as an urban buzz problem.
Right.
So net result, what have they done? We go to the middle of Singapore.
Yeah.
They have mixed it all up.
Right.
Right. There is, of course, the central business district. But all inside it, around it, there is residential.
Right.
Right next to it is the new Singapore Management University. Usi mein banaya hai. Usme theater banaya hai. So what have they done? They have basically thought of it as clustering problem.
Right.
Whereas we think about it as a mechanical problem. So hamari yahan zone hai. Arey, why are you working in a residential area?
Right.
Tumko kya problem hai?
Right.
If I'm doing a hazardous thing, it's a different matter.
A good example that, you know, I'm from a small part of Bangalore called HSR layout. So what happened in 2007-08, just organically, thoda startup chalu ho gaye. Some startups successful, which attracted more entrepreneurs. So people started, you know, giving their houses for rent to startups. Now there are hundreds of startups. It evolved organically. No, you know, planning involved, and it's a pretty buzzing area. But I think what you're trying to say is, you know, cities need to have their own personality, and see, things change, things evolve. So
yes. Now just imagine when I said master plan, I mean, like a startup, nahi ho sakta.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
This is only middle class housing.
Correct. That's right.
You know, and that, by the way, happens. A lot of our building codes, master plans are all based on this.
Right.
And there is a large amount of vested interest in this because, of course, low-level rent-seeking by inspectors and other such officials, municipal officials, happens on the basis of this. Mm-hmm. So this is, unfortunately, the problem.
Right. So problem samajh mein aa gaya. Who needs to solve this?
Well, ultimately, at some level, we need to first solve it intellectually.
Right.
So before we solve it in the policies themselves, we need to evangelize the new thinking process.
Right.
You see, all of this is the result of a certain kind of rigid mindset of the 1940s, 50s.
Right.
Which people don't understand the extent to which this Nehruvian socialism seeped into every aspect of life.
Yeah.
And although we have ripped it out of the area of economics, wahan bhi milta hai, a lot of it still around.
Right.
But, you know, we have to intellectually destroy it first.
Right.
Then you see the system itself begins to write itself.
Right.
Even today, the default of any problem that turns up is that Sarkar should set up a new department to solve it. The My Bad Sarkar attitude is still there.
Right.
So first you need to destroy that.
Right. So I mean, I guess maybe my translation, maybe all of us need to take interest in, you know,
absolutely.
Cities belong to all of us, right?
The cities belong to all of us, to the citizens, ultimately, not to the municipal officials.
Right, yeah.
But we allow them and we don't even investigate into why they are doing it.
Right.
In fact, today only I published an article in Financial Express on the ridiculousness of the national building codes.
Mm.
And I understand you need some building codes for safety, structural integrity, etc. But, you know, the ridiculous things they have there in these national building codes. You know, some of them tell you the size of your prayer room. Tumko kya hai, what is, size of your, in a condominium, how big is the maximum size of your letterbox room? Why do you care? I want a larger letterbox room. What's your problem?
Fair. You know, speaking of building, right? So one is, you know, building cities organically is one kind of, you know, large project. But you know, earlier you shared with me, you have, you know, interest in building ships, which is something I would not have, you know, imagined from your work, Sanjeev. But sounded very fascinating. We'll put out some pictures of this. Well, tell us, you know, this very interesting ship project that you've been involved in.
So this derives out of my interest in maritime history.
Mm-hmm.
As you may be aware, I've written a book called The Ocean of Churn, which is a history of the Indian Ocean. So as a part of that research, and I've written extensively on this, I pointed out that, look, we have this really great maritime history.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, all of it involved sailing all over the Indian Ocean and beyond.
Yeah.
So what were the ships we were using to do this? And so I began researching the kinds of ships.
Yeah.
And it turns out that we had many designs of ships, but one of the big major naval architecture technologies we used was to stitch our ships together.
Mm-hmm.
Not nail it together, but stitch them together.
Stitching is different than gluing.
The stitch is different than gluing. They were literally stitching them together using coir rope.
Right.
Now, this technique is almost died out, but it is still around in some villages here and there for building small local boats.
Mm-hmm.
So I said that, like, before this thousands of year old technology completely dies out, let me use some of these last artisans who know how to build it to actually try and build an ancient ship.
Yeah.
So ships like this have not been built in many generations.
Mm.
And I chose a ship from a painting in Ajanta.
Achha.
So this is a 15-year-old design. Right. So you know, 1,500-year-old design from the Gupta period, right, from the Ajanta cave.
Mm.
Then I found a whole bunch of books from a little bit later called the Yukti Kalpataru, which Raja Bhoj had written in the 10th century. So using that, using other evidence, some of it still living in these artisans I talked about, we then began to reconstruct a boat, ship, which is already being built with the support of the Ministry of Culture and the Indian Navy.
Yeah.
In Goa, there is a shipyard called Hodi where this ship is being constructed by these last few artisans who know these this technique. So the ship is being built.
Yeah.
It will be finished in early 2025.
Mm-hmm.
And then it will require some testing, outfitting, etc. So it should be ready for a voyage in late 25.
Yeah.
As it happens to be, Prime Minister Modi of India and the Sultan of Oman have made a joint declaration that there will be an Indo-Oman voyage.
Yeah.
The first voyage of this ship will happen from India to Muscat.
Wow, that's incredible. That's outstanding.
So there'll be late 2025. Right. So, you know, we have had a lot of support from the Bengal public, the Navy, the Ministry of Culture, and of course, the Honorable Prime Minister has been a big supporter.
That's amazing. You know, we'll look forward to, I think, the successful sailing of this ship. But I think it's also symbolic of, I think the larger point is, there's so much of ancient technology and know-how. Because this ship was prowling, you know, and you've talked about this extensively in your book, right? You know, both the Arabic Ocean and, you know.
Yes, in fact, we want to sail the ship later on from Orissa to Indonesia as well.
Wow, right. And I mean, a lot of us don't realize, but, you know, 2,000 years ago, we had ships, you know, made here, which was going to all these parts, very active trade, cultural influence. And somebody also, Sanjeev, think, I mean, you obviously have very deep personal interest, hence you're going out researching these topics, writing about it, building ships based on ancient technology. But all of the young Indian, also, there's some avenues for people to learn more about this. Because, you know, our history is also, agar padhte bhi hai,
absolutely. So you have seen, I'm personally trying to enthuse it, but you have to understand, as I keep said right in the beginning, we're trying to rebuild a civilization. So in order to rebuild a civilization, we need to tell our own story ourselves.
Right.
And it has to be a story of an energetic, active civilization.
Right.
Instead, the colonial period, and even after the colonial period, what is the story we tell ourselves? No, we are some sort of a passive people. We won our independence by, you know, politely requesting the British to leave. You know, our greatest king was some guy called Ashoka who had said, no, we shouldn't fight wars. Utter rubbish. Even Ashoka, nothing pacifist about him. Even when he regrets the fact that he had invaded Kalinga and killed all those people, he in the very next inscription says, right below that, that if you forest tribes behave badly, I'll do the same thing to you. So there's nothing pacifist about it. All this storytelling about us being some sort of a pacifist, inactive civilization, which other people came and occupied us all the time.
Yeah.
This is a colonial history that has been told to us.
Right.
Why were they telling us? Basically, they wanted to tell that, you know, you people have been around for a long time, but you always get ruled by some other people.
Right.
Please don't try and do anything active.
Right.
So the fact that we have this incredible maritime history of outward exploration and navigation, etc., is simply blanked out of our memory.
Mm. And one, you know, the challenge of, you know, the colonial period is, one is British did what they did, but part of, you know,
was the perpetuation post-independence. Right,
because, you know, mind also gets colonized, you know. And
we got colonized in the head. And again, here you have to understand who were the intellectuals post-independence.
Yeah.
They were not the people who fought for independence.
Right.
Our post-colonial intellectuals were almost entirely derived from the collaborator class.
Mm. Right.
You go and look at any of the great intellectuals of our post, you know, the next 50 years.
Yeah.
Very, very few of them were actually involved in the freedom struggle.
Right.
They or their immediate predecessors, ancestors, were part of the colonial establishment.
Right.
They were, that's why they had access to English language.
Right.
Many of them were ICS officers, imperial police service officers.
Yeah.
Who are these people? They are the collaborators.
Right.
They are the guys who were ordering the police to fire on the Quit India movement. It wasn't always the British officers. It was Indian officers.
Yeah, I think at their peak, I think there were only a few hundred thousand British.
Absolutely. So this, there was a large collaborator class. Mm-hmm. And after independence, what happens is that the Nehruvians, of course, they themselves do well, mm-hmm. but they keep out all the other participants in the freedom struggle because they see them as political rivals. Mm-hmm. This, of course, true of the revolutionaries, but even within the Congress party, you mm-hmm. see likes of Rajaji, etc., mm-hmm. sidelined. So now what happens is because a very small group of people leaves behind a small group of Nehruvians running the country, they need other people to help mm-hmm. them. So who helps them? It is the collaborator class.
Right.
So what happens is that the British leave, but the collaborators are in the mm-hmm. system.
Yeah.
They are the guys who get promoted.
Right.
So the biggest beneficiaries of independence is not the guys who fought for freedom.
Right.
But the collaborators who are in the system, they now get suddenly promoted because the British are leaving.
Right.
So they are getting rapidly promoted.
Mm-hmm. Right. Got it. So in some ways, you know, one can say we're almost, there was a political freedom which was achieved, let's say, 1947, where Indians were, you know, ruling the country in some way, our democratic system. But there's an ideological freedom.
There's intellectual freedom, economic freedom, mm-hmm. cultural freedom. That is happening only in the last couple few decades,
right?
And it's began to really take form from the 90s,
right?
With economic freedom right. finally happening,
right?
And then it begins because economic freedom allows a new class of middle right. class, new individuals who can mm-hmm. who can forge their own destiny outside of the license permit system. Mm-hmm. So now you can have independent thought,
right?
And that bunch of people who came out of that,
right?
Around about 2010, they begin, mm-hmm. you know. They began to write books right. and other things. Mm-hmm. And their influence is now filtering through the system.
Right. And do you see, like, over the next 20, 30 years, in some ways, we'll have just much deeper, richer, nuanced history of last 2,000 years in
absolutely.
Our...
So you are seeing new people mm-hmm. challenging these things.
Yeah.
There'll be more nuanced, more wider histories, local histories,
yeah.
other ways, not just histories, the way they manifest into not
right.
just textbooks, is the boring mm-hmm. part,
right.
but into popular culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you will see all kinds of new ways in which it will transfer through to the general consciousness
right.
of India.
Right. Sanjay, I want to come back to a little bit of, you know, policy. It's just a little bit more inside view of policy making. You know, what goes into that? When you pick up and think, you talk about, you know, bankruptcy reform. Or I think you also talk a lot about legal, you know, system reform. So when you think about a reform at a country scale, where does your process start? You know, big idea, research work, understanding nuances, and also then getting it through the, you know,
government. So there is no one way in this happens. It happens in multiple sure. ways in different parts of the government. So I'm going to talk about how I do it.
Take
there
it.
Are other parts of the government
sure.
doing it in other ways.
Take
so I am the part of the Prime Minister's Economic mm-hmm. Council. So obviously we work very close to the Prime Minister's office. So there are certain ideas, for example, either the Prime Minister himself has mm-hmm. or a ministry somewhere in the system mm-hmm. has come up with.
Right.
And that idea then goes... the thinking through of
yeah.
that, it is sent to us. So we have a look at it.
Mm.
And sometimes it's a bad idea. A lot of them are bad ideas.
Right.
Somebody met the Prime Minister, handed a mm. thing. So it comes to us to have a look at
yeah.
it. So some, but then there are also good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So then supposing it looks like a promising idea,
yeah.
then we dig deep into it, talk mm-hmm. to the relevant ministries, etc.
Yeah.
So that is one way in which
right.
A policy gets done. So, you know, either Prime Minister himself or somebody gave him the idea, or it came from a ministry
yeah.
or somewhere,
right.
an idea turns up,
hmm.
comes down to us, we investigate it,
right.
flesh it out, and then pros, cons, etc. are discussed.
Right.
And then sometimes we write a public paper also mm-hmm. about it. You may have seen that.
Right.
So that is one way of it.
Yeah.
Other is suo moto, we come up with an idea
mm-hmm.
because we did some research, we
yeah.
found something, or we met somebody, or industry group came, or some think tank
mm-hmm.
came, or somebody came up with an idea.
Right.
And we then investigated. So that is where the idea goes up.
Mm-hmm.
We do the work and then we send it up saying,
right.
maybe this is a good idea. Sometimes those ideas are accepted, sometimes
right.
they are not.
Right.
So there is no one way in which it happens.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things which we try to do,
mm-hmm.
which may be somewhat different from earlier eras, you will see a lot of articles, working papers, etc. coming out from the Prime Minister's Economic
mm-hmm.
Council, where an idea is just fleshed out and put out as a working paper.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Why are we doing this? Because we want to see, get the general public,
right.
Maybe related groups in that area to discuss or think about this idea. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, our idea may be a bad idea.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So just because we thought of it doesn't mean it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. So sometimes good to get, you know, put the idea out in the working paper. Let's see what happens.
And some of this, you know, policy things are obviously very complicated and some probably simple also at their root, as you earlier mentioned. But I'd say I'm asking this question from, you know, more younger people's point of view who have interest in learning about policy, maybe developing a point of view or commenting on things. You know, what's a good way for a younger person to get involved in the process?
So there are several ways in which you can get involved. well, if you want, there is the formal routes of doing this, mm-hmm. which is either you become a politician, become an MP, and yeah. then do it. That is one way of getting into policymaking. And then maybe you can become even a minister. So there's the political route. There is the old bureaucratic route, the UPSC route. You join the thing and then make your way up the bureaucracy. But the government also takes on board people who are have made a name for themselves in various fields. And there are places where they bring them on board. So one of the areas is the Prime Minister's Economic Council. There's also Niti Aayog. There is many other positions like the Chief Economic Advisor, Principal Economic Advisor. I was myself the Principal Economic Advisor in the Finance Ministry before coming here. These are roles all taken from outside the system.
Yeah.
So in that case, you have to make your name in some field outside, and then the government co-opts you into the system.
Right.
So there are many ways in which you can participate. You can also participate by just being completely outside the system, working for a think tank or academia or writing. But you have to publish.
Right.
Well thought out pieces and repeatedly doing that, make your case over and over again, update your ideas with data, etc. If you're in the conversation,
right,
in the newspapers, in blogs, etc.,
right,
you know, in every little field, there aren't only that many people discussing something.
Right.
People think that, you know, there's a huge government, huge right. country. No. On any issue, there are five people at most.
Right. So if someone were to build depth, you know, do their homework, study under the new...
And hammer away, you'll be surprised how quickly you actually get co-opted into the conversation.
Right. Right.
You know, CII may take you on, FICCI may take you on, government may take you on, you know, ORF, and there are a whole bunch of...
Right.
Delhi School of Economics may think you're a great guy. So there are many ways.
Right.
So I think the trick is to be willing to take on a few issues.
Right.
Be willing to think it deeply and then stick with it. Not, you know, maine ek article likh diya na, now I've gone home. No. You have to stick with it, update your ideas, refine it.
Right.
All ideas can be refined to being better.
Right.
So you have to stick with the idea over long periods of time.
Yeah.
And then this wheel of time will come.
Right.
But you should be ready.
Right, right.
You know, when the Kal Chakra turns in your favor, that is not the time in which you say, you know, you should be starting your work. If you've been in the field, writing about it, making noise about it, after a while, one, your own ideas will improve.
Right.
Two, people will recognize that you are somebody in that field and writes about it.
Yeah. Well, that's an excellent advice and very actionable. I think, you know, people can pursue that. Sanjeev, your work is overall obviously very serious work. You are deeply involved in nation building. It's deeply intellectual work as well. I think your studying of history, I can only imagine, you know, going to all these esoteric sources. But how do you wind down? You know, what do you do for fun? You know, what's the lighter side of Sanjeev?
Well, I am very much into sports.
Yeah.
So, I play a lot of sports. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, my body is now beginning to protest. Otherwise, till very recently, I was heavily into martial arts.
Yeah.
I'm a black belt in taekwondo.
Oh, incredible.
And I, till very recently, used to do full-on sparring.
Mm-hmm.
Used to also play a lot of squash.
Government ko allow karte hain full-on sparring? Matlab kuch ho gaya na?
Haan, karte the. I mean, they have never stopped me. My body is now protesting.
Right.
It's nothing else. It's not that I get injured more, but once I do get injured, it takes a long time to recover. And so I used to do, by the way, in college, I used to do paragliding. I have one of India's first paragliding licenses.
Oh, wow.
But I have not paraglided for a long time. Kayaking, canoeing, so a lot of sports.
Hmm.
So I have not yet ended up in golf, but I have softened the sports a little bit. But yeah, I do play a lot of sports.
Yeah. Golf can also get pretty stiff. I actually used to play golf in my 20s. You don't judge me. But I think it depends on how competitive.
So I'm let me put it this way. My personality type can't even deal with cricket. So golf to be chance. I'm the one of those guys who says that I will watch test cricket only if you get rid of the helmets and pads.
Right. Okay. Fair. Okay. Golf. So I think 70s, 80s. or body line, you know, that's your...
Body line should be compulsory.
Compulsory, okay.
Then maybe I'll watch the sport.
Right. Okay, that's giving you some window into your way of thinking. But Sanjeev, I mean, this, I have to ask you this. You excel in so many different fields. And you have this, you know, intensity about you. But also depth. As in, you really go into this, right? It's a... how does your day-to-day look like? You know, not that easy to taekwondo black belt, you know, from building this ship to writing 7 books, right, to 6 economic surveys and kaise karte ho?
So firstly, there's no order in my day. I fully embrace my life, full immersion. Yeah. So I am at every point in time doing everything all the time. So this is what is called a full court press in basketball. But because I'm enjoying all of it, it's not stressing me.
Right.
I'm out there doing all kinds of things all the time. Right. So, you know, sometimes I can't sleep. I'll wake up and begin writing a chapter of one of my books.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm traveling. Mm-hmm. I add in something else. So, I fully embrace life in a sense.
So you fully embrace life and just be yourself, be at it, and things happen.
Yeah, and you know, I don't waste my time on thinking about karna chahiye. Main pehle karne lagta hu, fir sochta hu ki. So in fact, even my intellectual framework for whether it is my history or it is my policy making is that iteration rather than grand plan.
Right.
So I save a lot of time when not doing grand plans. I begin doing whatever I think is worth doing. Along the way, I figure out what should be done.
Right. Got it. On that note, you know, it's sort of your advice to younger people. Today, India is very ambitious. And thanks to, you know, the work that you have done, the government has done, people are now able to dream big. They want to do something big in life. So youngster watching this, you know, what advice is? Like, you know, how can they manage their time, their career, their choices to be able to like really maximize their potential?
Well, very difficult to provide advice to in a general principles to other people in life. But I think one way of living life, there may are many ways of living life. One way of living life is to think of it as an adventure and jump in.
Right.
Now, if it is something that is sort of doable.
Mm.
Now, don't think if you're a 5'1" person, don't try to become a basketball great. Right. It's not going to be able to.
Yeah.
But if it's something that is within realms of possibility and maybe you have some chance of doing it in, I think you should just do it.
So jump in, you know, make bold choices.
Make a few choices, persist with it for some reasonable time. The chances are that in many and disproportionate number of cases it will begin to yield results. Now that doesn't mean that you have to dedicate your life to that thing, but you'll be surprised how often a little bit of persistence and a little bit of diving in gets you further than you think. In fact, you are yourself an example of that.
Thank you. You know, I think so what you're saying is just don't hold yourself back. You know, take some risk, be bold, and just learn as you go along versus too much intellectualizing. On that note, Sanjeev, I want to really thank you. I think your work is super inspiring. I think what you've done for the country is incredible. I think a lot of people are rightfully so extremely thankful and also very inspired by not only the work you do, but also your approach to work, and you know, you go out of your way to communicate your ideas in a way which is easily accessible from very dense policy paper, economic surveys, also in some ways interesting read, to books which are, you know, very, very easily, readily accessible. So I just want to thank you for the work you do as well as taking time to talk to us on this podcast. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks. At Sparks, we aim to bring to you stories of exponential impact. We share in-depth analysis of what goes behind success stories. If you find our conversations interesting, you can join us by subscribing to our YouTube channel. You can also listen to Sparks on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or any other audio platform of your choice. If you have any suggestions on who we should invite or what topics we need to cover, just let us know in the comments. We are always listening, looking for ways to improve, and keep getting better as we go along.